Welcome to the Right Take Podcast, news, ideas, and conversations at the intersection of politics and culture, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I will be your host, Mark Tapson. Greetings and welcome back to the Right Take Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Tapson. As I've noted before in this podcast, and as I'm sure you are all aware, this year is the 250th anniversary of our great country. I recently had a reader of mine ask if I felt that the celebration for that, so far, seems somewhat muted in comparison to the 200th anniversary in 1976, which saw a tremendous national outpouring of patriotism. And my response was, yes, I do think it's rather muted so far, but consider what America was like 50 years ago. Yes, the country was wrestling with anti-war sentiment over Vietnam, but the subversive influence of cultural Marxism hadn't yet taken hold. Patriotism wasn't yet a dirty word except on the radical fringes of the culture, and the globalist left hadn't yet begun dismantling American power and prosperity. America now has been gutted by the progressive left, which captured all the institutions of the culture, the news media, education, the entertainment industry, even our churches, and they've spent the last half century indoctrinating generation after generation to view their own country and civilization as evil, secularizing us, and teaching us that America's founding was grounded in racism, not freedom. So it's no wonder that this anniversary has not unified and galvanized the country as it did in 76. That is 1976. However, I do anticipate that much more celebratory hoopla and genuine pride will make their presence felt around July 4th itself. And meanwhile, underneath the radar of the culture at large, there's a revival underway of patriotism and historical and civic education going on outside the mainstream educational system that I feel very optimistic about. The American spirit that once thrived is coming back, I believe. Anyway, because it's the 250th anniversary, there's a lot of patriotic material getting published these days. I had Hillsdale College professor Matthew Spaulding on, for example, in a recent episode, talking about his book on the Declaration of Independence called The Making of the American Mind. Last week, I had another Hillsdale professor, Matthew Meehan, talking about his amazing new book of American fables. This week, I have yet another Hillsdale professor with a very insightful take on the Declaration of Independence. I'm promoting Hillsdale people so much, they should give me an honorary degree or something. But seriously, it's just coincidental. They just happen to be pumping out great work that I want to support and promote. So stay tuned. You don't want to miss this conversation, and don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take if you don't already, so you don't miss any of the compelling conversations we're having here. Don't touch that dial. My guest today at the intersection of politics and culture is the Russell Amos Kirk Chair in American Studies and a professor of history at Hillsdale College. He is the author of 13 books, including the award-winning Russell Kirk, American Conservative, and his brand new book, The Declaration of Independence, which we're going to get into today. Bradley Berzer, welcome to the Right Take Podcast.
Mark, thank you. And what a great title for your podcast. I love it. It's great.
Thank you. And thanks so much for your time.
Absolutely.
Obviously, this year is our 250th anniversary, so there's a lot of patriotic material that's getting published out there. I had, for example, your Hillsdale colleague Matthew Spaulding on in a recent episode talking about the Declaration of Independence. What is different about your approach in your new book?
Oh, yeah, thanks. That's a great question. And Matt, of course, is a very good friend of mine. And I love what he did with his book. And I hope it gets all the publicity that it so deserves. The thing that's a little bit different about my book, so I was really taken, my college president is Larry Arn, and he wrote a book several years ago called The Founder's Key, which looks at what the Declaration means to America. And so when I was asked by AIER, when they solicited this manuscript from me, just roughly about 2 years ago, I looked at Dr. Arn's book and I thought, well, there's already been a really good book written on the reputation of the Declaration. And so what I wanted to do was more or less write a prequel to that. That is, I wanted to write a book leading up to the Founder's Key and explain explain how the Declaration came to be. And so the way I broke it down in my first four chapters of the book, and they are kind of staid and academic, there's nothing too fancy about them. I just go through kind of a point by point development and evolution of the question of independence and what that means. And it's really in chapters 5 and 6 that I have a blast. And in those chapters, I'm talking about the very structure and the influences on the Declaration. And I had an absolutely, I mean, I had a great time with the whole book, don't get me wrong. But there was just something fun about chapters 5 and 6 that were different from 1 through 4. And so that was really, for me, that's the heart of the book. But I will say this. And I hope this doesn't come across, and I mean, you asked the question, and I appreciate the question. So I hope this doesn't come across as cocky. The one thing I do, so I really intended this book to be just a kind of synthesis of other works. I did not intend for it to be original. But the one thing that I think I do contribute that's original is the discussion of Anglo-Saxon law and culture on the founding. That's something that very, very few scholars have talked about. And one of the reasons they haven't, there's a good reason they haven't talked about it. One of the main reasons is in the 19th century, if you had said Anglo-Saxon, that was code for white. That is not what I mean. I'm not in any way arguing about race. I'm arguing specifically about the culture, the language, and the law of the Anglo-Saxons. So I'm trying to kind of salvage a term that the racists took over in the 19th century.
This is a sort of a personal question, I guess. You have 7 kids.
Yes.
Which tops me. I have 5, and I think that's probably it for me. But you dedicate the book to your 3 sons, praying that they become virtuous citizens of the Republic. Did your role as a father shape the way that you approached writing this book?
Yeah, it did. I wrestled with that a little bit because, of course, I've been trained as an academic to be as objective as possible. But I don't actually believe objectivity is always a virtue. And I don't believe that it leads to a successful book or idea all the time. And so what I really tried to do was reconcile the idea that, yes, I absolutely love the founding. I love these guys. I love the document. I love the moment. And I thought, you know, I can't hide that. There's just no way. And I wouldn't want to hide it. So there is something, there's a tension in the book where I'm both very much a patriot and also a scholar. And I'll say this, Mark, I mean, I feel good about it because I feel like I bridged it. Okay. Maybe 20 years from now, I'll look back at the book and say, oh, I shouldn't have done that or that. But at this moment, you know, 3 weeks after the book's been out, I think, yeah, I'm happy with the way that turned out. But certainly as a father, let's put it this way. We live in a republic, and our republic, any republic, demands certain things of its citizens. It demands first and foremost that we believe in the common good, that we believe that there is a kind of objective community that we all sacrifice for. And so, yeah, I believe that very strongly. And I want I desperately want my sons to emulate that too. I want my daughters to emulate it as well. I have another book coming out later that I dedicated to my daughters. That one's on Tolkien. So totally, totally different topic. Anyway, I thought, okay, when we're thinking about kind of manly virtue and George Washington and John Adams, it fits with sons. And I hope they appreciate that. But yeah, Mark, that's a great question. Really great question.
Yeah, I completely agree with that sentiment. Your enthusiasm throughout the book really comes through. And I have to say that I really enjoyed your acknowledgments section, which I don't think I've ever said to an author. It was just bursting with enthusiasm and gratitude and passion for the subject and some of the characters at the heart of it, one of whom is Thomas Jefferson, whom you call the embodiment of America and the polar star of discovery. What makes Jefferson so central to your interpretation of the Declaration?
Yeah, you know, Jefferson, and there's good and bad, obviously. You know, there's Jefferson the slaveholder that I think all of us who love Jefferson just kind of cringe and say, why? You obviously knew better than that, and yet you went along with it. And so I feel like in so many ways, Jefferson is America. He is America at its best, and he's America at its worst. And so in that way, he really defines who and what we are. But I will say this, and of course, you know, all my students, I get to teach American Founding every fourth semester at Hillsdale, and I love it. It's a great privilege to be able to do that. But it's always about a third of the way through a semester, a student will raise his hand and say, but Dr. Berzer, these guys own slaves. And you know, they're right. I mean, of course. And there's no way of getting around that. It's like, yeah, we have to wrestle with that. You know, here are these guys who are openly Republican and believe in natural law and natural rights and common law, and yet they own slaves. That's a really, really hard thing to reconcile. You know, we don't have to be leftists to reconcile. It's just to be American, we have to reconcile that. And, you know, not to get too political, Mark, but I was thinking, you know, just a few weeks ago, again, not to be political, but just to be somewhat objective about this, you know, remember when Artemis, our great moonshot, went around the moon? If I remember right, it was a Monday night. And I thought, yes, you know, I mean, I had not felt that patriotic in years. I was just so excited by that. And yet the next morning we woke up and we had waiting for us that tweet from President Trump, in which he said, by the end of today, we will have destroyed Iranian culture and civilization. And I thought, oh, is this, yeah. I mean, is this not America, right? I mean, the evening before we circled the moon, the coolest thing we ever could have done, and the next day we're talking about destroying, you know, arguably one of the oldest civilizations in world history. And of course, it didn't happen that way, and thank God it didn't. But it's one of those things, and when I think about something like the founding, it's like, yeah, this is absolutely the best. And at the same time, we've got these problems. It's just so deeply American in so many ways. I think that tension is.
Well, in addition to Jefferson, and also you mentioned George Washington as important influences on the Declaration, there's John Adams, who said that the real American Revolution happened in the minds and hearts of the people well before any shots were even fired. How do you trace that intellectual and moral transformation?
Right. Again, another great question. So John Adams, I love John Adams, and I think he's one of those guys. Ever since David McCullough came out with his biography of John Adams has held a high place in the American founding. But before that, he really didn't. It was McCullough that made John Adams kind of a going concern again. He was always kind of that dumpy, embarrassing, obnoxious guy from the founding. And I think that's really unfair. And I've been influenced by McCullough as well. But I just think that Adams is an amazing figure. And, you know, as early as 1765, he's calling for independence, long before it was even close to a mainstream idea. He was calling for it. And I don't think we give him enough credit for that. But one of the reasons he had called for independence so early is because he was witness to, you know, a wonderful moment where James Otis interrupts an admiralty court. And we as Americans hated admiralty courts because it was an imposition of naval law on land. And as Americans, we believe that only common law, the right to a trial by jury, the right to be innocent until proven guilty, we believe that only that had legitimacy on American soil. And so in February of 1761, James Otis interrupts an admiralty court. And he gives, and mostly because he has the backing of the Bostonians who are threatening the judges, he gives a 3-hour oration. And we don't know how sober he was. He was an alcoholic, and he may, even though this was early morning, he may have been already fairly drunk, but he gives this just amazing speech in which, you know, John and Sam Adams, or they're young men, really young men, they're right out of college. And they're watching this, and they basically say, this is the beginning of the end. You know, to see Otis take down these three judges, to take on the British Empire in all of its might, this is the beginning. And so John says, and I love the way he puts this, that was the conception, that was the conceiving of liberty. And then 15 years later, so remember that was February of 1761, and then 15 years later, in July of 1776, that liberty joined its manhood. It became a young man at age 15. And so that's the way that Adams puts it. And I love that because, you know, you think about, well, sure, there, of course, there's warfare and there's the Continental Army and the militias and everything. But unless the people believed in those ideals, nobody on the field fighting is ever going to have the backing of the population unless there's already been a revolution that took place in their hearts and minds. And so that, I think Adams just captures that. It's like, no, he's right. You know, basically the whole population, not the whole, but at least a third of the population is adamantly in favor of this struggle. And, you know, otherwise we would never have been able to field an army like we fielded. And again, you know, it's, we have to remember this. We defeated the largest empire the world has ever seen. And just by citizen soldiers, that's it. Guys with guns. You know, it's amazing. Absolutely amazing.
Well, along those lines, in tracing the moral roots of the revolution, you also bring up the Roman historian Tacitus.
Right.
And the Roman Republic's obsession with virtue. How did these ancient pre-Christian concepts of honor and virtue shape the mindset of the colonists?
Yeah, so the way I look at it, Mark, there are really three great ideas that deeply influenced the founding. One was Protestantism. I know that we often talk about the founding and we talk about the Enlightenment, but there were only three great Enlightenment figures and they really mattered. There's no question about that, but it was Jefferson, Franklin, and Benjamin Rush. And other than that, you know, if you would go into the population and start talking Enlightenment ideals, no one would have a clue what you're talking about. But these people are deeply, and I say this as a Roman Catholic, you know, these people are deeply Protestant. As Edmund Burke said, they are the most Protestant of Protestants anywhere in the world. And, you know, it's worth remembering that when they colonize North America, they are in the middle of the English Civil War and in the middle of the English Reformation. You know, it's Anglicans versus Calvinists, and they hate each other. But, you know, this isn't Luther 100 years earlier. These guys are actually settling America during their Reformation. And so they are a deeply reformational people. And I think we just have to say, you know, no matter what our own personal preferences are, these guys were deeply Protestant. But the second thing that really mattered to them was what we would call Republican liberty. They truly believed that in the natural law, God had determined that we would have free will, that we would be moral agents. You know, even the Calvinists, they may not believe that about eternity, but they believe that about here and now. And so we're moral agents. But the third thing, and this is something we as Americans in 2026 have a very hard time grappling with, they are deeply classical and liberally educated. And so, you know, any kid, let's say that you're a Massachusetts farm kid and maybe you only go to school when you're 8, 9, and 10. And then once you're 10, you're going to be working in the fields. You're old enough to farm. You know, so maybe you go to school for 3 years. The only thing you would have learned in that school, the only thing that was taught was Greek and Latin. That's it. And so, you know, this is a totally different world from what we're used to. And all of college, you know, to get into college, they had entrance exams. There were only 9 colleges in America, but they all had the same entrance exams. You had to be able to translate all of the first 3 chapters of St. John's Gospel from Greek into Latin. And then you would have to translate 3 of Cicero's orations from Latin into English. And then you would have to translate the first 1,500 lines of the Aeneid from Latin into English. So, you know, that, and you were, when you went to college then, you were 14. You went to college ages 14 through 17. So if you're that fluent in Greek and Latin at age 14, you know, this is just an utterly different world than what we're used to. And so,
sadly.
Yeah, you know, and even, and I love this, one of my favorite examples of this, you know, if you think about the Battle of Yorktown, the last great battle of the Revolution, it was two-thirds French and one-third American in terms of the makeup of the soldiers. Well, hardly any Americans spoke French and hardly any French spoke English. And so all the battlefield orders were in Latin at Yorktown, because that was their only common language. So, you know, again, it's just an utterly different world. So when someone like Tacitus is brought up, these are people who've read Tacitus in the original, and they love Tacitus, and they love Aristotle, and they love Cicero. You know, so they're a deeply, deeply classical people. And one of the things that Tacitus said, which is just amazing, he had, because he hated the Roman Empire, he loved the Roman Republic, but he hated the Empire. He had written a book called The Germania, or The Germania, I'm never sure how to pronounce it. And it's a history of the Germanic peoples, which includes the Anglo-Saxons, the people who would become the English. And in that book, and again, it's probably idealized because he's making fun of the Romans, but he says, if we look at the Germans, they have an elective monarchy. Their monarch is always their best man, and he can never govern except by his witan, what we would call Congress or Parliament. And if you look at the marriages, they never divorce. They don't believe in adultery. They don't believe in abortion. In fact, abortion is one of the greatest crimes you can commit among the German peoples. And they don't allow homosexuality and all of this. And they have the common law already. And it's like, wow, these sound like pretty interesting people. And so, you know, someone like Jefferson reads that and he says, yeah, we're Anglo-Saxons. We've been that way since before Christianity. So the colonists love that. They love that idea that Tacitus explained who they were before even the Christians showed up.
You argue that the American Revolution was simultaneously deeply conservative, but also radically innovative. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, sure. Well, again, Mark, this goes back to our point, the point I was making a little bit ago, where we think about, you know, at one moment we've got the moonshot and the next morning we're ready to destroy a civilization. This is deeply American. And, you know, you think about something like the founding, you know, here we are overthrowing our government, but at the same time, we are completely embracing common law, which is thousands of years old. So in one way, we're deeply conservative. We're preserving all of our ancient customs. And yet at the same time, we're firing at the king, and we're firing at the king's men, and we're ready to break away from them. You know, and I think about other things as well. We keep a trial by jury. But what do we introduce? The concept that all people are free to practice their religion as long as their practice doesn't harm another person's practice of their religion. You know, and that's utterly radical to think about that. Or if we think about the Declaration, all men are created equal. Well, that statement is deeply rooted in Christianity. It's very conservative. And yet when Christianity said it, when Paul said neither Greek nor Jew, neither male nor female, it was utterly radical. You know, this is something the world had never understood, except for the Stoics a little bit, but they're a minor philosophical sect. Christianity makes that real. And then you get to someone like Thomas Jefferson. And of course, he's not a Christian, but he's deeply influenced by Christian culture and Christian theology. And he says, all men are created equal. Right? There's no asterisk. It's not all men except Missouri Synod Lutherans, or all men except Jews, or all men except blacks. It's all men. And so at one point, that's a deeply conservative statement because it's rooted in St. Paul. But in another way, it's incredibly radical because no one had ever made it real before. So those are the kinds of things. And I think, I'm an 80s guy. I was in seventh grade when Ronald Reagan was elected, and I was a senior in college when the wall came down. And I think about the 80s. What was the great tension? Well, you had Ronald Reagan, who, and I think he was one of our greatest presidents, but you have Ronald Reagan, who's deeply rooted in the past. But you think about the other great figure of the 1980s in America, it's Steve Jobs, who's absolutely taking us into the future in every way. And it's not shocking to me that the 80s were as prosperous as they were because we were rooted in traditional morality, but we were exploring individual creativity at the same time. And that's what I think is going on with the revolution. You've got this deeply conservative moment, but it's also quite radical. And again, just utterly American.
You already touched on this a little bit, but I want to draw it out a little more, maybe. You frame the Declaration not just as a legal document, but as a national covenant, like the Mayflower Compact. What's the significance of viewing the founding of America through the lens of a religious covenant rather than a modern secular social contract?
Right. It's really interesting. If it is just a social contract, it can be undone very easily. If it's a covenant, it's rooted as a timeless thing within time. That is, it's an eternal thing that's rooted in time itself. And so, when Jefferson writes the Declaration, I don't think he had any intention of making it a covenant. Remember, he's a deist. He loves Jesus as a philosopher, but doesn't take seriously any of the miracles or the idea that he's the son of God. He's a deist, right? And probably the most hardcore deist, even more than Franklin, in the American Revolutionary period. He's the great deist. So we wouldn't really attribute Christianity to him other than culturally and maybe philosophically. But when Congress gets a hold of the document, they add, and we pledge our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor under the protection and care of divine providence. And once they do that, they have made the Declaration a covenant. It's no longer just an agreement of man to man, but now an agreement of man to man with God as the witness. And so it becomes something similar to a marriage vow, right? It's not just man and woman, it's man and woman and God, at least in a sacramental marriage. It's man and woman and God. And the same thing is true here. So, we can imagine we could pass, Congress this year could easily undo a subsidy or could employ a subsidy or could undo a tariff or employ a tariff. But, and those are, that's just normal legislation. But the Declaration's not like that. The Declaration is a unique one-time event, just like Abraham talking to God or Moses talking to God. It has that kind of weight to it. And I always want to be careful because I don't want to suggest, Mark, that somehow America is equal to Christianity. I don't mean that at all, and it would be heretical to believe that. But I think we would be equally foolish to say that America was not deeply influenced and reflective of Christianity. And I'm sure this is accidental. I have no question that this is completely accidental. But if you look at the structure of the Declaration and consider how it's laid out, where you have the naming of God, and then you have the understanding of man, and then you have the petitions, and then you end with naming God again, it is rhetorically identical to the Lord's Prayer. And I'm sure that's completely an accident, but it still makes it fascinating. And again, I think it says, look, it's not a Christian document, but it could never have existed without Christianity.
Well, speaking of Jefferson, again, the Continental Congress made some edits to his original draft, including entirely deleting his passage condemning the international slave trade. You think those edits ultimately weaken Jefferson's vision or improve on it?
Both. So it's not an either-or, but a both-and, Mark. So, the idea that Congress added, we pledge our lives, that's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. And in some ways, I don't think Jefferson was capable of that just because he wasn't Christian, but the vast majority of Congress was. So they understood that, and they understood that it needed to be a covenant. So that's fantastic. That improves Jefferson immensely. But, you know, when Georgia and South Carolina object to what Jefferson had written about slavery, that's terrible. That's tragic. I mean, can you imagine, Mark, if right there in our founding document we had ended slavery, what a different world we would live in. You know, if we had just in one fell swoop blamed it on the king and moved on, which was possible. I mean, it was really possible at the time. Yeah. You know, one thing that we as historians often don't talk about is from roughly 1761 until 1793 with the development of the cotton gin, there's a 32-year period there where slavery decreases by anywhere from 33% to 50% in American. And it's all because you can't say things like all men are created equal and then keep someone in bondage. So you've got just hundreds, if not thousands, of slave owners just releasing their slaves in that time period. That all radically changes with the cotton gin. You know, the cotton gin makes slavery profitable again. But I think it's important to note that when the founders say things like, okay, we'll keep slavery, they really believe it's on its way out naturally. They're not thinking this thing's going to last the next 1,000 years. They're thinking it'll last a generation or two more, and then it's done.
And also, Jefferson famously swapped out John Locke's classic triad of life, liberty, and property for the pursuit of happiness. What changes when happiness and civic virtue are prioritized over just material property?
Yeah, that's a great question, Mark. And I wrestled with that a lot in the book, trying to figure out why did Jefferson do that? And what are the implications for that? And remember, Jefferson very famously was asked in May of 1825, right? So he's 14 months away from dying. He doesn't know that, of course, but he's at the end of his life. This is 49 years after signing the Declaration, and he's an old man, so he probably doesn't have the best memory at this point. But he does say, and it's our best evidence, he says, look, the Declaration is merely the common sense of the subject. That is, I was giving voice to what every American thought at the time. There's nothing new in it. There's nothing innovative. These are the ideas of Aristotle, Cicero, Sidney, and Locke. And so that's, you know, Mark, that's our best evidence of trying to figure out, okay, where does this come from? What does this mean? And one of the things we know is that as classical as the American colonists were, they rarely identified with the Greeks. They always identified with the Romans. And so Aristotle is just not brought up at the founding, hardly at all. Whereas Cicero is you can't go anywhere in the founding without Cicero being quoted. He is everywhere. And so I thought, okay, and again, I could be wrong about this, Mark. I took a guess. I took a leap of faith in this. I thought, okay, where is Aristotle playing a role? Well, in book 10 of the Ethics, Aristotle says we should pursue our happiness. Why? For two reasons. Number one, when we pursue our happiness, we please God, because it's God who's given us our gifts. But number two, our happiness comes from being excellent in using the gifts that God has given us. And I thought, okay, that's maybe one way that Jefferson would have been influenced by that, because we know how deeply wrapped up Jefferson was in the idea of excellence. And so the pursuit of, if we take that line of thinking, and I'm probably a minority in that, Mark, I don't want to present myself as saying this is what every historian believes. I think I'm definitely in a minority. I think it's a significant minority, but I'm probably on the losing side of that. But if you look at the implications of that, you know, if we say we have a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, well, happiness isn't just sitting around getting high and binge watching Netflix. right? It's actually about doing good. It's about whatever excellent thing God has given me, I will make it the best that I can. You know, whether that's playing tennis or being a good friend or a good cook or whatever, or helping the homeless, whatever it may be, you pursue that excellence because that's your way of thanking God for his gifts to you. And so I love that. And that to me, and of course I love Aristotle on that. And Aristotle's not religious. You know, he hardly ever talks about God. So when he does, it's like, oh, okay, we should take this, you know, Plato's always talking about God. Aristotle rarely does. So we need to take it seriously when he does. So that's my interpretation. But I think most scholars would say, Jefferson meant it more in an Epicurean sense. That is, you know, we should enjoy a good meal and a good glass of wine and so forth. And I don't buy that. But I can see their argument. I can see where they're coming from.
You mentioned in the book, you write about the antipathy of progressives, past and present, for the concept of natural rights. What explains that? That antipathy.
Yeah, and let me admit my bias here, Mark. I am deeply conservative as a person. Mm-hmm. I am not at all. I have no sympathy for progressivism at all. I believe in progress, of course, but I don't believe in progressivism. Progressivism is a historical idea. It's not even a political idea. It can be political, but it's a historical idea that says, essentially, we have these moments, we live them, and then we move on to the next moment. And it's all rooted in Darwinian thought. So it's all about the evolution. And so what the progressives, especially the progressives, say, of Woodrow Wilson's era, who are the first major progressives, first of all, we have to recognize they are deeply, deeply racist people. You can't get more racist than Woodrow Wilson. He's the one who segregated the army. He segregated the Navy. He segregated Washington, D.C. He segregated every government office. You know, he just kind of laughed when blacks were lynched. He's a horrible, horrible man in every way, and truly one of our worst presidents, but just a despicable person. But he's not alone. The progressives overall were basically very white Anglo-Saxon Protestants in the worst way. I have nothing against white Anglo-Saxons or Protestants, but this is, you know, to the nth degree these guys are. They hated Catholics. They hated Jews. They hated Lutherans, which they basically thought were Catholics. They hated blacks. They hated Hispanics. You know, just any, and they always talked about the language they would use. They wanted to yank the hyphen out of hyphenated Americans. And so when Jefferson says something like all men are created equal, that's for them, that's cringy. They're just embarrassed by that. You know, how could Jefferson be so naive? Obviously, someone from Poland or someone from Zimbabwe could not be equal to an Englishman, right? And that's where that Anglo-Saxonism has become race now rather than culture or language. And I would consider it a perversion of a truth, but you know, that's what they're arguing. But I would say this about progressivism too. Not only is it traditionally deeply racist, and I know that would offend a modern progressive, and probably most modern progressives are very well-meaning. I just don't think they know their history. And if they did, they would be embarrassed. But again, I think they're probably very well-meaning. But the other thing to keep in mind about progressivism always posits a greater good. That is, all of history is based on conflict between the haves and the have-nots. Whereas if you look at a Christian Augustinian view of history, or even a pagan Ciceronian view of history, which I would subscribe to, either Cicero or Augustine, it says, no, you know, you and I, Mark, we both give up a little bit of our rights. We both give it up for the common good. We recognize what that common good is. We've each given up a little bit, and then we each gain mightily. And it doesn't matter if we're white or black or male or female, we all do this. And so we benefit. And what is history then from a Christian perspective? Well, history is not Napoleon. History is your mom making the sacrifice to raise you and maybe homeschool you when she could have been a brilliant CEO. And does she brag about it? No. She, you know, history is made by quiet moments of charity that no one will ever recognize. That's what a Ciceronian or an Augustinian vision of history is. It's not this grand sweeping of us versus them. It's a continual sacrifice of person for another. I mean, it's essentially, if I can be crass, a traditional view of history is that love moves everything. A progressive vision of history is that power moves everything. And so they're diametrically opposed. And so that's why I'm adamantly against the progressives.
You rely almost exclusively on primary sources in your book. Did you discover anything in the founder's words that modern readers most need to hear again today? And in a related question, what would you like this book to accomplish for readers who want to understand why the Declaration continues to, as you put it, speak to our very souls 250 years later?
Yeah. Again, Mark, these are great questions and hard ones. So let me say this about thinking about what's up with the Declaration itself and the language that they use. So I have been, and I tried to make this clear in the acknowledgments, I have been deeply influenced by a number of other Revolutionary War scholars. I did not want to make the book about them. I wanted to dig as deeply as possible into the primary sources. And part of that is it's a Hillsdale thing. We love going to the source. Always. It's very much a liberal arts Hillsdale thing. The same thing would be true at St. John's or at Notre Dame or the University of Dallas. You know, I mean, it's a very liberal arts thing to do. But I would say this as well. The founders truly were exceptional men and women. And I say women too, because you've got people like Abigail Adams or Mercy Otis Warren, who are at every bit the equal of every man of that era. And I don't think we often remember that, and we should. You know, there are incredible figures in all of this, who are both men and women. But I do think that we come to a moment that is classical and Christian in its flourishing. That is, the founding is not just one damn thing after another, right? It is actually a moment of beauty and truth and goodness and grace that is made manifest in the world. And I think the greatest proof of that is that they said all men are created equal. Because I firmly believe that once we've made that statement, you can never backtrack. You can only go forward. And that, you know, that's one reason that twice in the book I quote Calvin Coolidge, right? Where he says there is something exceedingly restful about the Declaration. You know, once I have said all men are created equal, that's final. Once I have said that all men are endowed by their Creator, that is final. Once I have said that among these rights are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that is final. You can't go anywhere except making that real. And so, you know, one of my great heroes, Martin Luther King, loved the Declaration. Why? Because he said it was a promissory note. And so I would go so far, right? July 5th of 1776 was probably very little different than July 4th. Mm-hmm. But by the time you get to the 13th Amendment, yeah, America's pretty different when you've suddenly freed 4 million black slaves. Why? Because all men are created equal. That's really different. When Martin Luther King in the 1950s, you know, locks arm in arm with other blacks and they march after church on Sundays and white Southerners attack them with dogs and fire hoses and billy clubs, you know, they are those black men and women are making very real through great sacrifice. All men are created equal. And so I really firmly believe that all of American history is a working out of that one sentence. I think that almost everything we've done is a working out. And when it comes to black-white relations, I'd give us a B. you know, it's not perfect by any means. There's still racism. There's still problems. There's still too much poverty in the Black community. Those are things that we need to work on. I will say this, and I don't want to end on a negative note, Mark, so I hope you have another question too. But I would say this, when it comes to American Indians, we don't have that happy story. You know, we haven't made American Indians equal. They're still subjugated. You know, you go onto a reservation and you have 90% poverty and you have 90% alcoholism. And, you know, we don't, you know, you can go into East St. Louis and you can see 30% poverty, but that's very different than going on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. And so I think that when it comes to American Indians, we still have a long way to go to make the declaration real. So I don't want to say that it's over by any means.
Sure.
I think that it's still an unfolding project. And I don't have an answer. I don't know how to solve the Indian problem, but it is a problem. And it's one that I think we as Americans, as Christians, as Americans, we need to take very, very seriously.
Well, I guess that points to the point you made earlier about America being both good and bad and having to work out its issues as part of an ongoing process. And we're never going to be a utopian society,
I suppose.
Right. But it's something we work with and struggle with every day.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And in every level of community, state, federal government, absolutely.
Bradley, how can people best keep up with what you are writing and thinking?
Oh, yeah. Thanks, Mark. So I'm the founder of a website. It's now, it'll be 17 years old in just a month, I think 2 months, called The Imaginative Conservative. And I write a weekly piece. I've written a weekly piece for 17 years now there. So that's probably the best place to find me. I also have a website called Spirit of Cecilia, which is more dedicated to music and movies and literature. Four really close friends and I, five of us run that. But it's, you know, it's stuff. I'm really into rock music. That's my hobby. So,
me too.
Oh, really? Oh, that's great. So, yeah, yes. So I'm always writing reviews of new albums and things. So those are my two sides. My cultural side is over at the Imaginative Conservative, but my artistic side is at Spirit of Cecilia. And I, you know, we'd welcome readers there anytime. And then all my, if you're interested, I put all of my lectures at Hillsdale are up at YouTube. So I record every lecture. So anyone who's ever interested in any of those, you know, please check those out.
Excellent. Good to know. Well, I love the Imaginative Conservative. And
thanks, Mark.
You know, thank you for that.
It's been a labor of love.
Yes, I can tell. Listeners, I strongly urge you to get the Declaration of Independence from Bradley Berzer. As you can tell from this conversation, it offers some fascinating insights into the creation and significance of our founding document. Bradley Berzer, thanks for joining us at The Right Take.
Mark, it was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in. Don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take if you haven't already. And if you like what you hear, please leave that positive review. We'll be seeing you.